thanks also to Paul and Dale Berger for putting us up, myself and my friends Clint and Debbie, or should I say putting up with us, I'm not sure it be. It's been terrific to come here and meet everybody and be able to see some faces that we've spoken with and be able to come here and be in the presence of the commander as these sessions are coming through, and this is it's a real privilege to be here. So we all appreciate that very much. We appreciate everything that you all do, all the ground crew here, to put out the words that we so very much need. And I know, speaking for myself, I look forward to the next issue of The Contact, because I sort of don't do much else but read The Contact, and as I'm able to read the journal here and there, and believe me, we need this to stay in touch and understand what's going on, so we really appreciate that very much. We appreciate the hosts who are here, of course, who make this all possible. I'm just a guy that got on the radio and through whatever reason and was able to make connections with the commander to be able to do this, and that's basically my story, I guess. There isn't a whole lot to it beyond that. I'm one who is in a situation, I don't really care what happens to me, particularly if anything were to happen. It doesn't mean anything to me personally. And so I guess the way the commander talks, there's some risk associated with this association, but I don't feel that exactly. Haven't felt that way. Except early on, I would come out of the station on a dark night out into the dark parking lot, and I'd look around and think, well, I just had a pretty good session with the commander, with somebody, you know, denigrating all manner of government authority and everything else, and so what's awaiting me in the dark parking lot? Well, nothing's ever been there. So I have total faith that there isn't going to be anything there in the future.
Well, Sam, let's put that shoe back on the other foot. Do you come in the light?
Absolutely, I do. Absolutely, I do. Touché, as they say. Yes, I do in fact come in the light. And I don't know. Do we have time before? Is Gunther coming through at 3 o'clock?
We don't.
That was the plan.
Well, he's going to try. So.
Well, okay. In that case, let me ask you a question, Commander, if I may, regarding that. It is my perception that a lot of people are not aware of what it really means to come in the light. And people ask me how I feel so secure in knowing that you are who you are. And I say that I have been able to give you what I like to call a white light challenge, for want of a better way to put it. And they say, well, what does that mean? You know, okay, so the entity coming through says, sure, I'm coming in the light. What does that really mean? And I think people need to understand the universal law that's behind that. And it would be better if they heard it coming from you than from me, I think.
Well, you have to consider light and dark as the terminology utilized for dark being the adversary, light being the God of creation, creator God. Dark adversary can deal only in that which is already manifest. Everything is created from thought of God in light. Everything in the universe is basically nothing but light. So you are dealing with a creative power that can create from light and is light. Even your Bibles will say God is light. The adversary over here deals in energies, yes, but he can only manipulate that which is already manifest. So you have far more power in the light than you do in the darkness. When you want to clear your space, for instance, You don't even have to be a very good, goodly person. But you won't think unless you're in on this, unless you are guided and intuitively, instinctively, and intention-wise, you wish to become one with that God. That would be your goal. When you confront any energy, because usually the dark ones will show up first. They're usually sitting up there, you know, right by your ears saying, don't listen to that sucker. And as long as you allow that energy there, it is going to be the predominant energy. And every time that you give in to it, it wins around, you see, with you. Plug that other ear, it will say, because that one's going to really sucker you. They can do that right up until your grave. God allows that. He does not come in there and protect you unless you say, Father of creation, God light, protect me. I believe that we may have our call coming through. It will be going to Russbacher. We can discuss this later.
Well,
I got through. You're right on time.
To tonight's practice, hang up. To accept your call is being connected. Thank you for using MCI.
Hi, Gunther.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. We have you on the speaker.
Okay, I'm hearing you loud and clear.
All right, and let me introduce you to Sam Russell.
Good afternoon, Mr. Russell. How are you?
Good afternoon, Gunther. It's a pleasure to speak with you. I'm very well, sir. And how are you?
Well, things considered, quite well. The temperature today is about 92, 93 degrees. Humidity is a little bit high, therefore the heat index is more than just at a comfort level.
So they don't give you air conditioning in your facilities there, I gather?
You gather correctly, to say the least.
Well, it's a pleasure to have a chance to speak with you. I've had the opportunity of speaking with Ray Ellen a couple of times on the air, and she's a lovely, gracious lady, and we've had some terrific sessions with her, and so I'm very pleased to have this opportunity. It was a very sudden one, and so I'm very happy about that. How long will we have with you this afternoon?
I would estimate we'll have approximately an hour.
Okay.
The possibility does exist. I may have to break for supper, you know, for dinner, but I don't think so. I'll just pass.
All right. Well, we'll just go along until you give us the indication that we must disconnect.
Well, I think this should take priority over a simple meal. At least that's my feeling on it.
Yes. Well, you sound very good.
Well, as said, all things considered, I'm doing remarkably well. I'm holding my own, and I try to progress each day a little bit. I don't really want coronary bypass surgery while I'm incarcerated, so I'm doing everything possible to stave it off.
What is the status now of the parole hearing that we have been hearing about? There was an article in the Contact recently about the fact that there was a parole hearing coming up shortly that would possibly allow you to get out of the jail in order to have the bypass surgery.
The hearing was held. It was a reconsideration hearing to make a determination whether or not there was probable cause to release me back to the community. I have yet to receive my return from that. However, all indications from the questions that were posed, I strongly surmise that I will be released in the near or intermediate future.
It really is beginning to look that favorable, then.
It looks good. It looks about as good as it can, considering I'm still in here. But I do believe that we've managed to break the barrier.
One of the earlier indications, well, after your first parole hearing, there was the possibility, evidently, that you might be deported. Is that still a possibility in the event the second one goes through?
I don't think so any longer. From all indications or what I've been told, someone in Washington has found some documents indicating that I am, in fact, an American citizen. Now, please know that my wife will be here this coming Wednesday, and I intend to turn these documents over to her at that time.
Yeah. Well,
so from all that I have been told and information that I've been able to gather, I will be released back into the community, and I will determine where I will reside.
Well,
likely not. I intend to spend considerable time overseas, specifically Austria.
Well, that's wonderful news that you'll be able to pretty much go where you would like to go rather than simply being deported as they indicated originally.
I would say that's far better than the original scenario set forth.
Yeah. What, obviously the reason you are in jail is that they are trying to keep you from readily revealing some of the things that you know. Is that a safe assumption?
I think that assumption is quite safe. However, I've broken the so-called solemn mandate by giving information to the public. And I think that's part of the cause for the harassment and maltreatment of my family and myself over the past several years.
Yeah. Have the conditions improved for you in the jail? In other words, have they taken you off the kitchen duty and so forth?
The conditions here have improved considerably over what they were prior to, let's say, a month ago. At least I'm not forced to bust tables and put my hands onto detergents with bleach, which in fact caused them to bleed or where the tissue separated from the nail beds.
That is an incredible thing. Could you describe, please, the circumstances that led to the condition of your hands?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Could you talk about the circumstances that led to the condition of your hands? In other words, you were in jail.
Certainly. And the problems originated in Laos, in Vientiane. I was a POW for a period of time, and one of the tactics that were employed by the Pathet Lao, or the communists that were in charge of the country, were to take the individual's hands and rip the fingernails out and or shoot bamboo shoots underneath the fingernails to the point where they would touch the first portion of the knuckle. And this was done repeatedly over a period of time without a chance that the nails would possibly have enough time to grow back. Over a period of time, it destroys the nail in its entirety.
That is something that most of us have.
In other words, what I'm saying is it could be classified as a form of torture.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a circumstance that we all just can't even conceive of happening.
Hello?
It's just an amazing, tragic situation that people find themselves in. How did you get out of that jail circumstance in Vietnam? How did that?
We're okay.
What happened?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. What happened?
We don't know. There was just a beeping sound on there.
Come on, Sculptor, I'm here. This is Commander.
Pardon?
We've got a lot of surveillance. This is Commander. This is Anton.
This is the Commander Hatton is hello. Commander Hatton is indicating that there's a good deal of surveillance taking place, and that was evidently some interference.
Yes, all at once the line went dead. I didn't realize that we had lost communication. I continued to speak. So if you'll tell me where we got cut off, I'll continue my rambling.
Actually, you were coming through okay here. Evidently, you lost us, but we did not lose you.
Okay.
So you were in the Vietnamese jail, and how were you released from that circumstance, since so few actually did, who were POWs in that area, ever did achieve their freedom?
Okay, Sam, let me clarify the position. I was not in the Vietnamese jail. I was in a Laotian jail, or
okay.
A POW camp. And it was, as I indicated just a few moments ago, run by the Pathet Lao. And they did not release me. I managed to strike out on my own. That's basically the scenario. I attempted to find other Americans who were capable health-wise or emotionally capable to leave the compound area to go with me. However, there were none. I was the only one that left on that evening.
I see. You were a...
Add one more point to it. When I left, I did manage to escape basically intact, although, as I said, my hands were not in the greatest of shape. Plus, I had abdominal wounds that were open. I was fortunate. I more fortunate than the rest of them, even though I had to take a life in order to get out.
How far did you have to go on foot, I gather, to finally arrive in a safe haven?
It was several hundred miles, considering the fact that I was traversing through country that was basically unknown to me. I'd seen it from the air, but never from the ground. I managed to make my way from the Laotian border through my Cambodia back into the Thailand area.
What was the mission that took you into that area in the first place?
The mission was a sub runner from the Red Dog Project, that is to say the Phoenix Project. Red Dog 1 was the denotion of my unit, and it was basically put into force to extract American POWs and or MIA personnel. We had done several of these over a period of time, and they were all fairly well successful to the point where we did extract several hundred Americans. But the last mission that I was on was compromised insofar as the United States was attempting to create a peace with the Vietnamese, Laotian, and the Cambodian governments through the Kissinger initiatives in Paris. So when we were fielded, obviously, there are some security aspects in place at that point that once the team is fielded, there's no point of recall. All communication between the command structure and the fielded team is severed, and the team proceeds to its destination or insertion place, does the operation, and extracts itself as to the best of its ability. During the time that we were in the field, the initiative was brought forth to the tables in Paris, and Kissinger, in a sign of good faith to the Laotian government, compromised our mission and let them know that we were on the way. So therefore, it didn't take much of a brainchild to make a determination that when you see some Soviet personnel coming your way, they were in fact Americans dressed up in Soviet garb.
So, early on at least...
Pardon?
Early on at least, then, it would seem the government did have the intention of trying to extract POWs. Then suddenly
early on, the intention was, it was far more than an intention. We actually did everything within our power to field specific teams to go in where we knew that there were American POWs or suspected MIA locations and get the men back out. We fielded several teams like that. Red Dog 1 was merely one of several.
So what happened?
Several teams met untimely ends in the bush, but we did have considerable result.
Why did the whole thing change, do you think? Why did that whole policy change for the POW?
It's difficult to say. I think that the United States became very, very tired of its involvement in the Southeast Asian Peninsula, and it was time to back out of there as gracefully as possible. The terms for disengagement were not exactly favorable to the United States, and considering the power structure and the so-called quote-unquote elite in Washington, including the Kissingerite, it was merely a question of time as to what can we give up to secure a fairly decent stable form of release, and they didn't give a damn whether they compromised missions or operations, or how many people that they left behind them dead in the field.
Yeah, so do you have any personal idea how many POWs were actually left behind?
Let me just basically clarify what my knowledge on this matter is. I saw stat maps and stat columns as to Americans that were suspected to have gone down in Laos and Cambodia and in various parts of North Vietnam. The totals that I seem to recall from those years were somewhere around 2,300 to 2,800, and they were continuously growing, so it was not merely a point that this was a fixed amount of Americans that were missing. Also, you have to bear in mind that there were other countries that had lost men also on various operations or cooperations with the United States of America, specifically referring to countries such as Canada, Australia, and a couple of the others that were part of the larger picture operating in Vietnam. One thing that clarify before we go on to a different subject is the man that I reported to, personally reported to, during that time frame was my interface or liaison in Saigon at Thompson Air Force Base. This man was, and still is, Donald Gregg. His boss was Robert Gates, so you can see what has transpired through the Reagan and Bush era, that these individuals that have basically managed to keep their mouths shut rose to positions of power, while others lost their lives or became incarcerated for not honoring the directive or the mandate for silence.
So we come forward in time after you achieve safety and so on.
I have a great deal of trouble hearing you.
I'm sorry. After you were able to gain safety from that episode...
Again, you broke up on me. You were able to, and then that's the last I heard of.
Okay, there is interference evidently. After you were able to get to safety after that situation...
I'm sorry, again, you broke up.
You have to speak into here for him to hear you.
Oh, I see. Is that better now?
You're Sam, you're breaking up. I hear about two or three words, and there is absolute silence on the line.
Can you hear me now? Is this a more consistent...
Hello?
Can you hear me now? Gunther? Can you hear me now at all?
Yeah, I'm not hearing anything.
I'm
alone on the phone.
Just speak right into here. I thought it was straight.
All right, is this better now? Gunther, can you hear me now? Gunther?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, can you hear me now?
I hear you. We're loud and clear. As a matter of fact, you're coming through extremely loud.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was trying overly hard there.
All right. And I hear the people in the background. So you're coming through extremely well and loud and clear.
Okay.
Shall we continue?
All right. After you were able to get to safety after that situation, what were some of the primary missions that you went on?
Some of the primary what?
Some of the primary missions that you were able to go on after that.
Okay. A lot of the missions dealt back with counterinsurgency, counterterrorism, and trying to ascertain which terrorist groups around the world met a criteria for funding. We worked hand-in-hand with a number of the KGB groups that were out in the field through the Paris and Bonn offices to fund specific terrorist groups to undermine certain governments and create economic chaos in Europe, all for the benefit of the United States, I suppose, in the short-term and long-term run. That is deemed to include the Brigate Rosso group, which is your RAF, Red Army faction out of Italy, the Lotto Continuo, which was an offshoot from one of the old communist groups, as well as the modern Meinhof group out of Germany, out of Frankfurt. Those
so,
were basically the ones that I was involved with.
So it was a continuing series of episodes. And I gather that these were basic CIA-type operations. Were these funded through black projects primarily, do you think?
They were funded entirely through black projects. There were no overt funds available to fund international terrorism, whatever name tag we might attach to it.
Yeah.
The obvious intent was to bring our own into the groups or to facilitate the insertion of special operatives into these groups and then turn them around to where they would work for us. A lot of times the information or the data that was brought forth was shared equally by KGB, GRU, and agency personnel, as well as our cousins in London.
So there are just ongoing activities. Of course, the drug activity, we understand, is probably the primary financial resource for CIA activities. But again,
guns, weaponry.
Ray Allen, when we spoke a few months ago, was saying that there were...
Yeah, I lost you again.
Can you hear me now?
Again, yes.
Okay. Ray Allen was saying when we talked on my show a few months ago that there were various factions within the CIA which Well, one of them, she indicated, owned Denny's restaurant, I think. Is that right?
I think they have a vested interest in it. I don't know whether they own it, but they do have definite control of certain areas of the country.
And another faction, she indicated, have a substantial portion of Pepsi-Cola.
Well, again, that's true as far as the statement is concerned. However, please bear in mind that PepsiCo International, and I'm specifically referring to the international headquarters in Barcelona, Spain, where Peter Van Turing was the executive vice president in charge of inter-European and inter-American affairs. PepsiCo International offered itself, as did IBM and a number of other major European concerns, or American-European concerns, offered themselves to permit American operatives, or operatives that we chose to work with us, cover, even to the point where personnel identification was established and housing and other interface work was accomplished through the PepsiCo channels. That is true and correct.
Yeah.
Ray did not overstate the issue. If anything, she understated it.
Well, what we were sort of leading to there was this was just about the time that the little episode of the hypodermic needles in Pepsi-Cola cans came to light, and she was indicating the very strong likelihood that this was some of the interplay between the two factions trying to get at each other.
Well, I think that thought was pretty well held to by a number of people within the agency proper. However, since then, I think that we've determined there's only been one or two real incidents. The rest of them were contrived.
Yeah. Well, now, you personally, I gather, were involved in setting up a number of covert kinds of organizations, financial organizations in the Missouri area?
In the Missouri area, as well as Chicago and Denver, et cetera, yes.
Yeah, and these were CIA front activities then?
They were proprietary operations owned and operated by the agency through straw parties, yes.
How many of these kinds of operations do you suppose there are around the country?
Are we talking about minor ones or major ones?
Well, let's talk about the major ones then. Yeah.
Major ones, I would say about 150 to 200 of them scattered throughout the United States. We're talking about agency operations, not Department of Justice, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so the Department of Justice is in addition to the agency.
Oh, absolutely. We work hand-in-hand with DOJ, especially when it comes to setting up law firms or going in with the U.S. District Court to setting up corrupt trustee systems, you know.
That's amazing. Well, just as an example of how some of this worked, what were you personally involved in then, and how did this benefit the overall goals of...
Are we talking again about agency operations, my particular mentee or forte?
Yeah, your particular activities, I gathered that there was an investment company of some kind that you were directly involved with. And
there were a number of them. Let me begin, if you like, at the beginning. First of all, we began with using considerable sums of agency funds to buy the charter of an existing SML in Redhill, Pennsylvania. It was called Hill Financial Savings and Loan. Okay, we did real well, and on the contrary, we didn't know what the hell we'd do with all the money we were making. So we were making overt loans, zero interest, and we didn't give a hoot whether they were paid back or not. To the local citizenry in Pennsylvania, as well as West Virginia and so on, the Appalachian coal areas, we lost about $55 million in the first year of giving out these sham loans. However, the influx of additional CIA funds and money that came from various operations such as drug and weaponry brought another $243 million to the table, so we didn't really know how to absorb it. We took the funds and we began with Hill Financial Services Incorporated, which was a spinoff of Hill Savings and Loan. I was the chairman of the board of both the organizations, and Donald Lutz, L-U-T-Z, was the president and part-time CEO. We took turns rotating. So anyway, these funds were put back into the Federal Reserve, or we took the funds and went to the Federal Reserve and said, would you care to do business with us? We'd like to have extensions of credit so we can grow within the community or the Eastern Appalachian area.
Got out there. Could you hold right there, please? So
the Federal Reserve plan is at times 3.5 or 5.5 to 1 for every deposit dollar we showed. The Federal Reserve ran a line of credit equal to 3.5, and sometimes as much as 5 times the amount of our deposit value or asset portfolio value. With these funds, we then began other companies throughout the United States. One of the companies that I was directly involved in and began with was a brokerage organization by the name of National Brokerage Company. Very simple, small, proprietary, sole proprietorship in St. Louis area. Within a matter of about 4.5 months, National Brokerage Company had grown by such astronomic proportions that it had to be incorporated and then spun off with 4 different other organizations. So National Brokerage Company became National Brokerage Companies Incorporated, then National Brokerage Companies International, then became National Financial Services, and National Realty, National Leasing, and such as that. We began to expand in the marketplace buying properties, manufacturing areas such as Southwest Lake Texas Incorporated. And then we turned our head to the airline industry. This is probably where we made the most significant impact. This is how we got in touch with the Denver-based groups that were interested in subverting funds that were intended for airport expansion projects, and we became involved in Tower 51 and Tower 54 projects with the MDC, Metropolitan Development Corporation, which in turn led us to Keating and Company. So it's,
oh, so you had a little involvement with Keating.
Eventually, some people stole more than others. Please don't.
Well, how would you rate Mr. Keating on that scale, then?
I would rate him initially that he was about an 85% real thief and a 15% victim. In the later years, he became about an 85% victim and 15% thief. His own people turned the tables on him. A lot of what he's been charged with or adjudicated for was not of his doing, was the doing of his board of directors.
Is that right? So,
which Larry Mazzello was one of the board of directors.
Well, I wanted to get into that a little bit just to kind of give an idea of the immensity of the activities of the CIA as I have been able to try to discern those. And obviously, the CIA activities, if you were able to do that with just your little projects, then the percentage of CIA activities to the gross national product must be pretty significant then.
I think that's a very fair statement. But let me add a point here that our caveat is for what began as a small business in St. Louis, Missouri, ended up in an international brokerage concern, which owned and operated 3 major airlines in the United States, including portions of Evergreen, which is still very viable in today's marketplace. It was National Brokerage Company in conjunction with some of the mob-related families out of Chicago that built the entire Traverse City convention area and arena and the entire housing project, that lays behind it. Not only did National Brokerage Company, in conjunction with Michigan National Bank, fund projects that totaled into the billions of dollars, they also began to explore acquiring and purchasing of cargo and transport aircraft. This is how Southern Air Transport came into being. Apollo Air, Apex Air, and the other CIA operations, they were all initially purchased and chartered out of National Brokerage Company funds. So it became a very, very lucrative business. It was a money funnel without end.
Wow, you had started doing that before you got into the CIA. You would have ended up being a real mogul, wouldn't you?
I made a terrible mistake. I believe that excitement made up for part of the loss when it came to money. But Lord only knows, I've had more than my share of excitement.
Well, let's talk about one of the primary areas of excitement, and that being the October surprise. Could you describe your particular portion of the scenario of the October surprise?
Well, where would you like for me to start? Would you like me to start pre-October surprise or that so-called fateful weekend? Or?
Well, maybe a little bit of the prelude to the weekend would be good.
All right. Prior to the actual October surprise, which took place in the October 19th weekend of 1980, a number of meetings were set. Most of these meetings were held in Europe. Only one of them was held in New York City. I attended, along with a couple of my cohorts, meetings in Barcelona, Spain, meetings in Madrid, meetings in Geneva, Switzerland. So I was very well knowledgeable of some of the events that led up to that weekend. But the main reason that I would like to share with you, the reason that I was brought into the, let's call it an operation to begin with, was the fact that I spoke fluent German. And one of the individuals out of the Iranian delegation spoke only Iranian or Farsi, French, and German. He said no English. Consequently, I was involved. I was a good translator.
Okay, we lost the microphone there for just a minute. We're sort of balancing things here.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
I'm sorry, we lost the microphone right there. We're kind of balancing this thing on my knee here. And anyway, you were involved in that because you were fluent in languages, in German particularly.
Particularly in German, but I also have fairly good working knowledge of French and a number of other languages. But I was at the right place at the right time, and I had already grown to know Peter Van Tine quite well. At that time, I was part of the time in Vienna, Austria, running an advertising company, 20th Century Advertising, for the agency.
So that put you into the right place at the right time, as you say. Well,
but again, bear in mind, I lived in St. Louis, Missouri at the time, or a suburb of St. Louis. So when the actual October trip took place, I was summoned to Washington, D.C. via telephone call and told basically to pack one bag and get on the next available commercial aircraft and get to Washington. And from there, I think the entire October surprise is now history, or pseudo-history, since Mr. Bush and Gaines do not want to accept as such.
Yeah. So you ended up being a pilot. I've heard reports that you were the pilot on the trip over to France and also on the way back. What is the correct version of this now?
The correct version of the entire thing, and I repeat, to the point of redundancy, that I regretfully acknowledge the fact that I was the command pilot on the BAC-1-11 going over to Paris, and much more regretfully acknowledge the fact that I was the pilot on the YF-12A coming back to the United States. Mr. George Bush is a passenger.
So you were the command pilot going over, and who else was on there? Who were the passengers on that flight?
I think that there's a pretty extensive passenger list already out who was on board that aircraft going over. And I've on a number of occasions given out the list, so I think EJ would probably be able to supply you with a copy of the list, or Raylan can. But for a point of time-wise, don't make me go through the whole thing.
Okay.
There were a lot of people on board.
Well, okay, suffice to say that some of the Bush and Casey were there, among many others, I guess.
Right, and there are one that was on board that aircraft, one particular individual that I would like to see, you know, basically brought to justice, is this idiot Rostenkowski out of Illinois.
Oh, he was on that flight?
Absolutely. And if you look at my depositions with Rodney Stitch, you'll find that I gave extensive coverage to this individual more than 2.5 years ago.
Ah. Well, Rostenkowski may be in a position of having his comeuppance here pretty quick if these hearings in the House get going.
Don't count on it, okay? Because I see much more stable and favorable information and data get swept under the rug.
Yeah. Well, the trip back in the SR-71 is something that has been a little bit controversial. I had I was talking about this on the air. Somebody called up and said it is impossible that the SR-71 requires a co-pilot in the back in order to fly the thing.
It doesn't require one. I don't know where people get that assumption. The SR-71 is perfectly capable of sustaining flight with one individual on board. There's been a lot of strange statements that have come out of the press. I'm talking about specifically the mainstream media, as well as some of the other media, regarding that flight back. And it would appear that the individuals that made these ridiculous, or let's say ludicrous comments, didn't know a damn thing about operation of a flying platform.
Yeah.
First of all, it was Rush Limbaugh, that my favorite individual, I might add, stated unequivocally that the YF-12A is a three-seater. Please know there were no three-seat YF-12As or SR-71 models ever throughout the entire history of the 71 program. There were one- and two-seaters. There are some people that took great objection to the fact that the 71 had a two-seater version. Please know most of them were two-seaters. Only the initial ones that were brought off the line from the Skunk Works were one-seater models. And also, it needs to be stretched and stated beyond any point of debate that the YF-12A or SR-71 is perfectly capable of operating at lower level flight. In other words, it does not have to be into the reaches of the ionosphere in order to be able to make the airplane fly. So if an aircraft, a 71 with a passenger, let's say a non-qualified, non-flying passenger, returns to the United States at a lower altimeter rating than going, and the going rate would be, or at basically the same speed, it does not affect the physical well-being of the passenger or the pilot.
Okay.
That comes to be when you reach the outer reaches of the ionosphere and the fringes of space.
Gunther, where does the name Richard Brennecke fit into this scenario?
Richard, again, I use the word regretfully, one of my cousins, and by that I'm talking about a true family member. Richard and I go back many, many years, all the way to Winnemucca, Nevada. Hello?
Yes.
I wasn't sure if I had lost you.
We were expecting a continuation of the story. Are you...
Well, Richard and I have had our falling out in the past. We've operated on joint operations in the Central American countries, specifically Central American highlands. We did some work, some joint work in the Mena, Arkansas area. We did a lot of joint work in Europe as far as arranging for transport of certain weapon systems to Iran and also to areas such as Libya, along with other individuals, some of whom are presently incarcerated.
Yeah.
Richard and I have not always seen eye to eye. Richard has usurped certain powers of a trust that we're both members of, and he asserted signatory powers, which he shouldn't have done, buying and selling helicopters as if the damn things were candy, to which I took exception. But other than that, he is a cousin, and therefore blood is thicker than water. I will stand by him until then.
Well, was he not on that flight also?
Was
Richard Brennecke also on that flight?
Oh, yes.
So
Richard was a co-pilot on that air.
Okay, he was a co-pilot on the flight.
The BAC-111 on the way over.
Yeah. And so he was going over there. Of course, George Bush roundly denies the fact that he was in Paris on that weekend, but of course, technically he was correct, right?
Richard's told a number of different stories with regards to that weekend, and I think a lot of them had to do with... A lot of the stories that he's told had to do with the fact that both he and Anne received some quite severe threats from Uncle Sam.
Yeah.
Should he testify, he will be in serious trouble. Now, on top of that, Richard had certain indiscretions with a certain lady on the East Coast, which in turn took a lot of the documents that Richard had and bastardized them and turned them around against Richard.
So George Bush roundly denies being in Paris, but he was technically correct because this whole meeting...
Bush doesn't deny being in Paris. Bush denies not being in the country.
Yeah. Yeah.
On that 24-hour period, please bear in mind that that's exactly what we're talking about, a period of time less than 24 hours.
Yeah, now technically he was correct in saying he wasn't in Paris because this meeting took place in a suburb of Paris, so he could weasel around.
Yes.
Yeah. Now on that flight back, there was a cockpit. On the flight back from Paris in the SR-71.
Back up, please. I lost you there for a bit, and I don't want to take your question in context.
Okay. On the flight back, on the return flight with George Bush in the back seat there, there was a videotape made of the passenger and I understand of yourself also. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
And that videotape about a year ago now, before the election.
I lost you again.
Okay, that videotape was said to have been taken to the, the Pentagon. And this tape was very explosive, and this was still prior to the election back in a year or so ago. And it resulted in George Bush's having the football taken away from him back then.
That is correct. And please bear in mind also that the tape was made available to Congressman Lee Hamilton and Larry Barcella, both of whom went to the agency headquarters at Langley and viewed the tape. There is a taped conversation between Congressman Hamilton, Larry Barcella, myself, and my wife, where Barcella and Hamilton were not aware of the fact that they were being taped and recorded, and they state unequivocally, yes, they had seen the tape.
Where do you think that tape is now? And
I don't know if I should even say, because the last time that I made certain of delivery of a copy of the tape, the individual lost his life thanks to it. And I'm referring specifically to Paul David Wilshire, my prior attorney.
And that was a fairly recent occurrence then, wasn't it, within the last few weeks?